The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Today is Thursday, March 2nd, 2023. Jeff O'Neill here back with Rebecca Shinsky, who's back from a little PTO, and is ready to pontificate with clarity, expertise,
yes,
and absolute certainty about the present and future of machine LLM-generated prose. So, Rebecca, Vanessa and I set the table. I'm going to clear out. I'm going to mute myself for the next 45
Great, cool.
minutes and just let do your thing.
Let me put my VR goggles on and I'm just going to monologue for a while about ChatGPT and all the things we obviously know about it, given its, 3 week long existence now. I'm totally ready. I have on my new progressive lenses I was telling you about. So I definitely have extra clarity of some kind.
Yes. Because what you want is people wearing newfangled bifocals to tell you about the future and all the hip things. That tech. You have them and I need them.
Greetings, fellow kids.
That's right. Speaking of alternate ways of reading things, did you see Liberty that she has been reading on her TV now? Did you see that on Instagram?
No, that's amazing.
So Liberty is one of, if not the only person I know, that not just endures, but actually enjoys reading a full book on her laptop. Fine. You know, we've tried to say, hey, have you heard of an e-reader?
Takes all kinds.
No, takes all kinds. What? But she went up a level of strangeness or down a level. I don't know. She's shambling towards stranger, more idiosyncratic uses of books. But she's now streaming, basically using AirPlay, it sounds like, to put them on her new 52-inch TV and like sit on her couch and read the book on the TV. And I can't tell if this is like one of those memes of we're all living in 2023 and this woman living in 2075, or it's, do we have the right prescription on Liberty? Do we need some? Maybe she would read VR goggles. That's where I'm kind of coming around to. Maybe she would actually use VR goggles, but I've never heard of this thing reading on your TV before.
I haven't heard of that either. It really gives me Ray Bradbury vibes of like, just right. throw that book up on the screens in your house. Yes. And next thing you know, like the next version of it is like surround sound, but surround screen, where like when you move from the kitchen to the bedroom, the book pages just go with you.
Right. Your AR goggles are just sort of casting the text on whatever flat surface it sees. And so you can just sort
of ambiently
read.
You just live inside the AR goggles. It's not like the book is coming from inside the house. The book just is the house.
There you go. You could probably get a six-figure deal for that right now. The book is the house. Done. Anyway, we've got some follow-up to do, some news stories to do. But we're going to take a quick break first and make way for a sponsor, and then we'll come back.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge strategy and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. May Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Should we do internal shadow things? So you've also written for Bookwright's mm-hmm. new subscription newsletter called The Deep Dive. I don't want to give it away because it's sort of the fun, but Rebecca writes about how much and how one might feel about how much they read. And longtime listeners of this show may intuit the way that goes, or you may not. I wouldn't say it's like a contrarian take, but no. For people who work in books, I'm not sure we have the rah-rah, books are magic. We don't have gear saying books are magic. Let's just put it that way. Is that fair to say, Rebecca? Is that a good shorthand for?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I do think longtime listeners of the show will probably know where I'm going there. Yeah. And as an additional hint, like the newsletter was originally slated to drop in January at the beginning of a new year when mm-hmm. people, you know, set particular kinds of goals. And that's what I was really thinking about. But it did kind of surprise me as I wrote it, you know, like that's one of the fun things about having space to do something yes. that's 1500 to 3000 words is you get to find out along the way what you think about it and where it's going. So I had a fun time discovering that. And I do know listeners of the show will have been especially interested in your long take
yeah.
on the biggest book of last year, of the last several years.
2 years? And how it's yeah.
a head scratcher in a lot of ways, but maybe not in the ways that the media has already acknowledged or even that we've talked about. Like you and I have spent substantial time talking about that thing together, mm-hmm. and there were some surprising things in your take about it to me as well.
Yeah, and I think the thing you just said is fun to do, and I even framed my piece this way of like, I'm going to use this to think through this feeling I haven't tried to figure out. And I think mm-hmm. I said on last week's show, Rebecca's trying to not spoil it, but I think I already spoiled it last week, that I don't remember the exact title of it, but it's something to the long of like, the Colleen Hoover phenomenon is the weirdest or most mysterious bookish phenomenon of my reading life. And I've felt that way, like it just felt different, and I use a lot of the things you've heard us talk about over time, but like the signal events and the reading events of my adult reading life, and especially when we've been doing the show, of like, you know, your Marie Kondos, your Harry Potters, your Hunger Games, your, I'm trying to, Where the Crawdad Sings, your Gone Girls. And they're all weird. By definition, they're weird, because otherwise they would just be another book that comes out. But this one is differently. It's strangely strange. It's differently different is kind of what I have been feeling, and I try to walk through that. And I don't actually spend that much time talking about the content of the book, frankly. There's a little bit, mm-hmm. or the quality or my opinion of it. It's not about that at all. So go check it out. I think I pumped out 2,500 words. My first draft was like 3,500. I was like, that's too much, Jeff, even for you. But it was a fun exploration, and go check that out. I'll put a link in the show notes. There's a free and a paid tier, like happens with these newsletters. I actually don't know myself if both of ours are in one or the other, but you can get some, and then if you want the rest, you have to pony up as these things go. So go check that out. Some other follow-up. Vanessa and I were trying to find something to be excited about when it comes to applications of ChatGPT in the world of books and reading. And we really couldn't come up with one on ourselves. We're like, I don't think right now this is going to produce anything interesting for me. If anything, it's going to gum up the work with a bunch of middling to lower quartile submissions and make gatekeeping even more important, but also less inclusive because it's just going to take more time to there's going to be so much more chaff. The chaff to wheat ratio is going to be strange for a little while, even worse than it normally is. So I asked listeners if they had use cases, the things they were excited about. I think for a reader like me, the answer is still no, but I thought I would mention one. One is someone who works in the tech and business side of books. And I think their take was, there's a lot of writing that I have to do and we have to do in the process side of like how to do this thing or summarize or other kinds of stuff that they'll find uses for. And I guess that's more just general knowledge worker use cases, which I can understand. But from a reader's point of view, will that lead to more better books? I don't really see it. Maybe publishing will be faster and more efficient, and the downstream effect of that would be a leaner, meaner, more agile, whatever, a more efficient producer of the crap I want to read. Okay, I'm sure that makes your job easier. I'm skeptical if that's going to make my reading life better. I had one person write in to say, I think you're right about fiction, at least for the time being. You know, who knows how these things are going to evolve.
Yeah.
But maybe on the nonfiction side, there might be something, right? Because nonfiction, a lot of nonfiction is looking at primary and secondary sources and then doing stuff with them to turning them into a different kind of container, whatever that might be. Mm-hmm. I can see that, maybe. Certainly not on the memoir autobiography side, because you have to do enough inputs to like tell your life story. I don't know that it would be time efficient, but I don't know if you're, say, wanting to write a new history or a new book about the Library of Alexandria, just to pick something in our field, maybe you could get big chunks of paragraphs or shortcut the research or combing through stuff. I don't know. I think that's interesting. I can imagine people doing a lot of the kind of schlocky stuff that happens on Amazon in the form of self-pub books right now for everything, or maybe there's just more of them. And so I don't know if you listen to the show, but the more I thought about it, the point that Vanessa and I came to where really it's just going to be more mediocre. There's going to be more mediocre stuff out there. And that just makes things harder in general. And I think all those places where there can be more mediocre, where volume, where taking up quote unquote shelf space is a function and can get you some marginal gains, it will happen there. But I don't tend to think that's going to happen in, to plug the Patreon episode we're doing, I don't think it's going to be churning out the new Rebecca Mackay book. It's just not anytime soon. It can generate, but it can't create. And that's pretty well. So anything that's summarization, repackaging, rephrasing, probably it can be really helpful in that. But on the bleeding edge of new, it just can't do that. It can't report news. You know, it can't do new analysis and opinion of stuff because it needs a huge data set of shit that's already out there.
Mm-hmm.
So by its definition, the realm of the new is not its purview.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see. I didn't get to listen to you and Vanessa talk about it, but to see like how, as you say, there will be more mediocre stuff out there, but like how far out there does it get? You know, like how much does it, will it succeed in permeating like what mainstream readers in this conversation have access to or have to wade through? The thing that I think we're seeing happen right now is it's still so new. We really don't know much about it. And everyone wants to know more than we do. So there can be policies and plans and procedures built around it and all sorts of like structure. Folks are trying to impose all kinds of structure around this in all kinds of industries. And we're seeing it in academia and, you know, like all over the place. And I think it's way too early. I both understand that impulse and think we don't know nearly enough about where this is going to go or how it's going to be used to make useful long-term structures. Right now, what we're doing with most of those structures is making ourselves feel better. Mm-hmm. Like in terms of real applications, I think what we might see this do in books is like in that summary kind of space, businesses like Blinkist, I would think, should be pretty worried. Yep. Like if you have built your business model on, we will give you a 15-minute summary of Atomic Habits so that you don't have to read it yourself. You should be pretty concerned when ChatGPT can do that for somebody. Or like yesterday, I got served an ad for, I think it was a Blinkist product that was like a Brené Brown deep dive. And it was like, here's your pack of eight. And I was like, first of all, you don't know me.
Yes.
And
got that wrong.
You got that one wrong. I'm going to read all of those. But also, like, ChatGPT could have answered that question for me. I put our company fave Radical Candor through it recently and said, like, you know, ChatGPT, give me like key points about feedback communication from Kim Scott's Radical Candor, because it's all over the internet. I thought it would be, you know, a thing that ChatGPT would have had plenty material to teach and feed itself on. And it was pretty darn good. So in terms of the nonfiction summary stuff, I do think that creates like a type of competition and maybe some push towards innovation for folks that are doing the original creating themselves. It'll be really interesting to see what people try to do with it with fiction. I don't think that's going to be very successful yet. And really, it's, I think in the immediate, probably going to come down to like online retailers, especially Amazon, trying to do a better job weeding out that stuff that is a summary of Where the Crawdads Sing instead of Where the Crawdads Sing, that fools readers who think that they're getting the whole book. There's probably a little bit more of that to handle. But it's also still, it's young and buggy. And, you know, like I watched a demo yesterday of a guy teaching ChatGPT that 2 + 2 = 5 and he succeeds in doing it.
Yeah, it's funny. So, it is funny that it is the results can be pretty wildly awesome and terrible at this. I mean, you can, you know, depending on what you do. My daughter and I were messing around with it because I was talking to her about it, and in a beginner's mind way, it's a really fun, it's kind of a fun exercise. Like, it's kind of a fun word game to play with ChatGPT. So we did something like, I think we said, write a poem about 5 chickens in the style of Dr. Seuss, and here are their names. And it was bad, but it did it, and it was in 30 seconds, and it was fast. Write the first 2 paragraphs of a murder mystery novel with the main character, Turds McGee. We are 9.
Great.
And 10
Love
and
it.
11 in my house, and I am me. So there's not a lot of guardrails on the silliness, I would say. And it wrote 2 paragraphs of very bad, well, it's not bad in terms of like a bunch of racism and grammatical errors, right? I guess that's the kind of the worst version of bad. But it was just so generic. It's like, yeah, I could have done that. It would have taken me just longer to write the words with my meat fingers. But it's nothing even close to something bordering on interesting. Like, you'd have to do you'd have to do enough prompt engineering. This is the new, the job title I've been seeing around, prompt engineer, which tells you that you need to learn how to use the tool. And right now, being a sufficiently good prompt engineer to get anything close to interesting prose from the prose point of view, not from just the informational dump point of view, but from like a prose thinking point of view, you might as well just write it, honestly.
Yeah, I think my experiences trying to put silly and creative stuff through it have been exactly the same there. If anything, it reinforces that at least where we are right now in March of 2023, art and craft come from something human and intangible. Yes. And that may shift. It may change. It may evolve as these tools get better. But there is still something very special and unique that a tool like this can't provide. And I think that's contributing to my like, all right, everybody, like, let's slow down on trying to put the policies around all the things so far. Like, why are we so scared of this thing when all of the current samples are showing us, hey, the thing that humans can do is still the thing that only humans can do?
Yeah. Well, and I think we both know the reasons. And sometimes things do go exponential and hockey stick and change the world. It's few. The other thing that's here is wrapped up in human identity and philosophy and theories of mind. And so this is a big one, right? This is not Google, right? Google was, I was telling my mom that I think it's probably the most interesting technology I've seen in my lifetime since, you know, the good search engines. I mean, honestly, I think
that's
could
right.
be that. And search has changed the world, but it also sort of hasn't, right? I mean, it can do a lot of the stuff that was looking up stuff in the Yellow Pages or needing an encyclopedia or using maps, and like that's really interesting. I don't think search didn't result in a bunch of new creativity. What search has done is people gaming algorithms to capture interest so you can serve them ads. And sometimes it's really amazing. Like Wikipedia is one of the great things that has happened in my life by itself. That's very search dependent, but some of it is like, I want to get in the way of the thing you're finding so I can put ads in front of you and affiliate links and all that kind of stuff.
And, right. And it's,
I don't know. That search is like, ships, what did search produce that's so great? Besides, you know, really on the creative long, point of view.
Really long prose introductions to recipes on the internet.
And that that's is a step what backward, Rebecca Shinsky. That is a step backward.
It yes. is. That is, yeah, that is 100% a step backward. And it's one of those things where, like, as search evolves, the things that we have to create to game search also evolve. Right. So, like, the way that folks would title blog posts 10 years ago is really different from the way that we title them now. The fact that you've got to, like, if you're a cooking blogger, you've got to put a super long introduction on your post because SEO wants that right now. SEO is going to want something different. And I think it's reasonable and wise to expect that this type of technology is going to evolve in a similar, if not same, way. What these robots do for us might stay about the same in the way that what search has done for us has stayed about the same, but the way they do it, or like what they're looking for, what you have to put into it to get what you want, might shift, or the ways that people will find ways to game it. And I think really the question that I'm seeing from businesses is like, how do I get ChatGPT to recommend my X, whatever it is? You know, right. like when it first came out, I was running through some of the prompts for articles that we've had, you know, real people write for Book Riot. Mm-hmm. And I had ChatGPT write me a list of 17 books like Gone Girl. And the titles were pretty good selections. The internet is filled with read-alikes for Gone Girl, so it's not hard to find. The prose itself, kind of okay. But if I'm the person writing the next Gone Girl read-alike or the publisher, I'm thinking about how do I get ChatGPT to do that? If in fact these AI bots become our replacement for search. And I think that's really the thing to have the eye on right now, at least, rather than what is this going to do to our art? It's like it might do something. I'm not saying it won't or that it couldn't, but right now I don't see any indication that we need to be worried about art here.
Yeah. And, you know, I know that people, and there's a really great book that stuck with me since grad school, Walter Ong's Orality and Illiteracy. It's about the transition from an oral culture to one of written language and all the attendant steps that come along with it. And any new development comes along with some panic, whether it's writing, right, the glyph itself, whether it's printing, whether it's offset type, whether it's an ebook, whether it's an audiobook. And their disruption can happen along the way. There's not a lot of I don't even know what you would call them, but like the people that would put in by hand each individual letter into the press and then swap it out for a new page, that job is done. I mean, there are still people that make book and printing, but computing is done a lot in automation and everything else, you know, and those people disrupted the scribes before them, and the scribes disrupted the oral storytellers. There's the one that stuck with me is when people first started sending messages that could be written down. So the very sort of dumbed down version is like, this king wants to communicate with this other thing. And rather than going and parlaying face to face or sending the king's official herald with the official sign and everything, sent a letter, right? Well, how do you know the king wrote that? Yeah. Right? Is it that different?
No,
there's that other piece of it too. But sometimes it really is that different. And I think that uncertainty is hard to live with because it could not be different and it could be real different. I mean, that's always a possibility. It's always a possibility.
Yeah, this has been making me want an additional chapter to Clive Thompson's Smarter Than You Think, which does a lot of the same work of the book that you were just talking about, of like, listen, when telephones were invented, we were sure that that was going to ruin social life. And then TVs came around and we were sure that that was going to ruin things. And then when books went from being just printed codexes to being ebooks, we were sure that that was going to change everything. And it's not that it's impossible that something will come along and completely overturn the old technology and the status quo in a way that's negative. It's just very rare that that's the way it goes. Rare. The change happens, the shift happens, but these like fundamental parts of human society and human need, including communicating with each other and creating things, are fundamental and really hard to overturn. So we get new tools, we get new ways of messing around with them, but it's really, really rare that something is just earth shattering. And I don't know, I guess I'm okay with the uncertainty. Like, it's new technology. Yeah. We've been doing this a long time. We've seen a lot of new technology. This is meaningfully different, and it could be much more disruptive than other things we've seen, but it also might not be. We don't know yet. Like, I'd like us to take a collective breath maybe around it and just let it be interesting and wonder about it a little more, rather than trying to like put stakes in the ground when we don't have ground really to stand on with this yet. I think we're still very much on shifting sands.
Yeah. And it's the familiar intellectual battle lines being drawn between sort of the naked futurists who assume everything is good and there aren't mm-hmm. any constraints at all. Just not that they shouldn't be, but there won't be. That the thing could do infinite work in infinite variety of ways. And then the more conservative, sometimes it's political, sometimes not, point of view, which is, I don't want that. That's bad. And mm-hmm. only bad things can come from it. I don't know. I don't think I'm either of those places right now. Let's say I guess maybe as a thought experiment, to say I had messed around with ChatGPT enough, say over the last couple months, and say, actually, it's pumping out something pretty close to a George Saunders short story. I'm just trying to think of the thing that's least mm-hmm, likely to mm-hmm. be disrupted by this. Right. Would I feel better or worse? I guess I don't know the answer to that. Because if that's the case, then basically there could be infinite George Saunders-like, and I'm not even saying mimicking it, but like gives me the reading feeling I get when I read someone like George Saunders, right? Of that creativity, insight, strangeness, you know, what you want. Or what I want from the highest level of reading for me. Say I could get that infinitely, that it wouldn't run out. That's essentially what we're talking about. Forget about the business mm-hmm. side. I'm not mm-hmm. a writer. I'm not an author. I don't know if this would change our business, Rebecca. Would people be advertising more or less? I don't really know. So put that aside. But as a reader, I guess the core question for me has been, and this comes down to whether or not SNS should be acquired by PRH, or what about audiobooks, or what are there enough of the kind of books I like? That, from a reader, that's my point of view. And I guess in my heart of hearts, would I care that much if I had infinite choice? I don't know. What it calls into question then, do I have much care that story is written by George Saunders, that I know mm-hmm. the person that came up with it? And that's undiscovered country. Like, I don't know how I'm going to feel if someday it's like it just got spat out by a large language model. Maybe I would ascribe the genius to the person who put together that algorithm. That's possible. Certainly possible.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a really interesting question, because so far we have not really succeeded as a species in separating the art from the artist in any kind of meaningful way, because you have to have the artist to get the art. But as you were talking, I was thinking about, like, what if some future version of a bot like this could create music? Like, if they're pumping out songs that make me feel the way that first Counting Crows album makes me feel, that transcendent thing you're looking for from art, if I can get that feeling, and that's the like piece of my humanity that's lit up by it, in the same way that, like, you get something, our humanity comes online in a special way when you read like a George Saunders story or a great work of literature, whatever that is to you. We've never really had the option. We haven't had the option of experiencing that as a product of anything other than another human. And does the experience feel different if it's a product of something else? I don't know. Should it feel different? I don't know. There's ethical questions. Mm-hmm. And I think there's even a question about whether there should be ethical questions. Right. Does art need to be made by humans? Would we have an obligation in some ethical models to support art made by humans rather than art made by AI? Mm-hmm. I can imagine what those arguments would look like in a lot of ways.
I'm very tired of them already. I can tell
and
you
I'm
that.
Very
I can feel them. I don't like them.
Same. I'm not really interested mm-hmm. in those. And maybe there's a more interesting version of them to have when it's not all theoretical. You know, like, there's not a good enough version of this yet to even have that conversation. It's all just hypothetical about what if somebody did this and then we had to do all these other things. And as you like to say, like, that's several ifs down the road. Mm-hmm. And trying to be several ifs down the road is just generally a crazy making place. Like, you, no wonder everyone's trying to write policies for stuff. Because if what you're doing is sitting around playing the what if game just infinitely, the what ifs can become very very overwhelming. But the reality of what we have here so far is something that can do something really interesting. If you're Google, you should be real worried about how this disrupts you. If you have a like a Blinkist kind of business, I think you have some valid concerns. But if you're in the art creation business, I think right now you're okay. And holding the question, holding the uncertainty, I think is the wise approach here, or at least trying to like right size our response to how this might be scary inside of what we do know, and just acknowledging that there's a whole lot of unknowns. And I think unknown unknowns, we don't even really know all the questions that we'll need to ask if, and that's a really big if, the technology ever becomes capable of creating something that even approximates human art.
Yeah, and the different, and I get it. Like, there is a version in which you do a compounding interest of ifs into the future, right? Where
yes,
it's wildly the future is wildly different than it is right now. What are you going to do about that right now? Remains to me. Let's say that's true. Let's say there's a non-zero probability of it being wildly different. Can you I just don't think you're going to legislate away this sort of technology and tool. We haven't seen that be effective. Like what? What technology have we come up with? Like, actually, you're not going to use that. We're just going to, through law, here's something that could be transformatively useful in a lot of ways, but it has some downsides we don't like. I mean, we have nuclear energy. Okay, you can't do nuclear weapons. Well, that's to some degree, that's an infrastructure problem, right? This isn't that. This is computing power. And computing power over time gets cheaper and smaller, and by its definition, ergo, less legislatable, right? Software is very hard to legislate, as we learned in college, right? Through Napster and other kinds of things.
And it's out of the box. Like, you can't put it back in there. This is in the world now.
Yeah. And the question really is, does it have enough room to run to get really good? Is you hear what I'm saying? Does it, are we really close to the beginning of what a text AI can do? Are we in the middle or are we towards the end? Because if we're at 0.0001%, well, that's something. If we're already at 40%, that's a different story. It's just a completely different story. I think from a legal point of view, we're going to do some more listener feedback in a minute. I think the law is going to be, now the law is something that can change, not to say the thing can or can't exist. I don't think that's possible. But how your own product can be used, how copyright can work, how royalties might work, because these large language models rely upon giant data sets, mind-boggling internet scale data sets, right?
Yeah, kind of unfathomable.
And that's not hyperbole. Like the amount of text out there is, I think it's approaching sort of like universe scale, the number of text characters are out there. But is all that fair game for a large language model? You know, can it basically, you write a large language model, you enter, say, go take the internet or all the books that Google has searched benignly. They told us benignly, right? They've been doing all that book scanning. I'm sure none of this has anything to do with it. It's all fine. Can you do that? If I'm the writer of, I don't know. Maybe I'm the APA in the, what's the diagnostic manual, DSM-9 or whatever.
Oh, the DSM, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's a hugely expensive work to write, right? And should be expensive and should, you know, people should have to pay for that, right? Is it okay for OpenAI to just scan that and make that available? It's one thing, because that's not plagiarism, right, Rebecca? Because you or I, if we read the DSM-9, and then someone asked a question about us, we could charge them to regurgitate the answer. We can't sell them a copy of the DSM-9, but we could read it. And if we had a photographic memory or just really good or had a really good set of note cards, that knowledge is ours to use. So it's this weird middle ground, right? Because if it can read and retain and scan and parse well enough to give someone an answer, but doesn't actually recreate the text, what's the deal? And so the Authors Guild has started putting in and is recommending people put into their book contracts that this text cannot go into a large language model from the publisher's point of view, nor their partners, and citing examples where, you know, stuff is getting fed into the, we talked about this show, Apple's efforts to do AI narration. Well, if you're going to do that, the text is in the system, right? The ghost is in the machine, or the machine has come for the ghost. So don't do that. because I don't want my text being part of the Borg that's going to shoot out new things. I think any individual author probably is not going to matter that much, but it does make me wonder, say, on Book Riot tomorrow, if there was some bit of code we could put on that says, nope, if it's a large language model, come a knocking, don't answer the door. And by the way, we need to see if you've slurped up all of our stuff, and if you have, you need to expurgate it. Like, is that something that's going to be enforceable in the future? It reminds me of image copyright in the wild and woolly early days of social media. It's very similar to me, right? So I think this is the kind of thing where we might be able to put some protections for the people who make stuff out there. I'd have to tell you, I'm not optimistic that's going to matter that much. I just am. I'm just not.
So. I would agree with that. And I think it's just not the question I'm most interested in. Like, as we think about how technology has shifted in the last 10, 15 years, really what the internet has done, the biggest concern I have about society inside that is that not just the law, but the way that we teach people about how to understand technology and media and what comes out of the internet is really lagging. And I think that teachers and educators have caught up to this. You know, my friends who are librarians are doing the Lord's work out there, teaching children to question the things that they learn on Google and TikTok. And when we start having more access to AI models where you could ask it a question about just about anything, you could ask it about a health concern you have or the symptoms of whatever, or I have these symptoms, what might this illness be? And all sorts of other things. Educated skepticism and understanding how to have that educated skepticism, the critical thinking around the output from this stuff, literacy around how to use these tools, what they're good for, what they're not good for, and the secondary layer of interpreting what this tool gives you rather than just taking it and assuming that it is correct or helpful. How do we work as a society with the acceptance of this is a thing and it's going to be a thing and it's going to grow in ways that we can't anticipate? How can we do a better job this time around about teaching ourselves and teaching younger people the ways to use it and the ways to have a healthy relationship to it? Outside of how do we protect what happens to authors or what happens to people who create things, which is a question worth asking, but on the bigger level, once a cat like this is out of its bag, I want us to more immediately move into how do we use this responsibly and how do we teach people to understand and use it responsibly rather than the just immediate responsive resistance to the things existing, because it does exist. So what are we going to do now?
And there's an element too that it even seems more like magic than the internet itself or search, because some of those key internet literacy tools are, what's the website? Do you trust the website? Is the author source? Does it seem like a real person? Does it seem like motivated reasoning? Can you then go Google, are jackalopes real? Or something like that. It's like you ask, what is a jackalope? And it says, well, it's this rabbit deer hybrid thing. And they're like, okay, you do some media literature on that. And you say, okay, I don't trust this website. And there's a bunch of other sources saying X. You ask, what is a jackalope to ChatGPT? It may give you one answer, but we're already seeing people tweaking those models, right? So, and you can't check the source. You have no idea. And neither do the people that make these things, because they are so mind-boggling complicated, you can't get under the hood to any particular question and say, where did that one come from? Because that's what AI is. It's not just an index with a bunch of sources. Right.
It's fed on the universe size of data that's out there now.
And it relies upon the universe sort of being true. It's kind of the ultimate crowdsourced thing. When you think about it that way, it's actually crowdsourced language. If that makes, I don't know if that helps anybody to understand what's happening here. It's not an AI, it's not an intelligence right now. It's really, really, really sophisticated algorithms that basically looks at everything that's ever been said on the internet, essentially. This is very boiling it down. And parsing that in a way to make a guess, frankly. When it gets it wrong, it can get wildly wrong. Really, really wrong.
I think that's also part of why at present I'm not worried about what this is doing to art or what it might do to art, because so much of written art, of literature, is in the subtlety and the unsaid. And these AI models are very literal and very concrete. Yes. Like, you can teach one that 2 + 2 = 5. If you tell it, no, next time I ask you what does 2 + 2 =, you will tell me 5. You know, it's that concrete. And when we'll stick with George Saunders, when somebody is writing a piece like that, writing a story like that, it's like really about the question of what does it mean to be human? What is empathy? The answers to those questions are not written as empathy is blah, blah, blah. Humanity is about blah, blah, blah. Like, that's what a chatbot will give you right now. What you get from the George Saunders interpretation of it is a story that evokes those ideas and makes you think about it, but never says, hey, now here is a story about empathy. Now here is a story about man's relationship to art. And, you know, it could, I guess it's possible, because anything is with technology, that it could get that good to do subtlety, to do the unsaid thing that exists between the words. But right now it is just the words. And that, it's a long way to go. It's a big gap to hop over.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not something we're going to keep our, again, if there's a really interesting new development, and I think for me that development would have to be, this is a thing created by a thing in a fairly straightforward way that is going to open your eyes. I can't imagine what I'm going to be super interested between here and there. That's just me.
Yeah, same.
All right, let's do another sponsor. We'll get into some other stories.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Had some more listener feedback. An employee, I think a current employee at Indigo, little Canadian bookstore, having a bit of a tech problem of their own.
Oh dear.
Ransomware, right? They're still being
That one. Okay, I didn't know if you were talking about a new one. Okay.
No. Apparently, they have a Shopify instance up now, Indigo, to try to some books. But this person sent me a picture of the cash line at an Indigo of late, and it looked like New Year's Eve. Before a snowstorm, and the apocalypse, like people buying books, which is fascinating. But also their loyalty program. We asked a couple weeks ago, or Vanessa and I were talking about Barnes & Noble's new loyalty program. And this person is saying that Indigo's loyalty program is very, very popular, and people use it a lot, especially, I guess, people come and buy a huge stack of manga and get 10% off and save themselves like 100, 200 bucks at a time, which is great. And she's like, I don't know. Maybe the muckety mucks at Indigo have a sense that these people wouldn't buy their books with us if we didn't have this versus, you know, a membership. The membership program is a little tough. Are you just giving your most loyal customers free crap that they would have spent that money anyway? Or you're getting marginal dollars you wouldn't have gotten otherwise? And I'm not sure that the literature on this is very good, right?
No.
It's like frequent flyer programs. If every airline has a frequent flyer program, then that becomes just sort of table stakes, right? That you have to have one. It doesn't become a differentiator. I guess like you have to have seats, but it doesn't actually help any individual business make more people fly. If anything, you know, they do different things. So I think it's an open question. Maybe on balance, if you can make it a little easier for you to buy one place versus another one. I was telling Vanessa, Rebecca, that my first loyalty thing of any kind was for the Raven, and it was a physical punch card. Yep. And if you spend $75, you got $10 off your next purchase. So a de facto 12.5%. And I think that kind of, I like that. I don't know that I would have spent my money differently, especially in the pre-Amazon days. But I'd have to admit, every time I go into Powell's, and I was just there yesterday to buy something, and I'm paying full freight, $32 for a hardback yesterday.
Spicy.
I was like, would I feel a little bit better about this if I got 10% off with my free membership card? And the answer to that, Rebecca Shinsky, is yes, I would. So I don't know what to tell you. Maybe that wouldn't, every now and again when I buy from a discount or online, maybe I do that a little bit less. I'm not sure, but keep those stories coming, folks out there.
It's interesting stuff.
Do you have a Barnes & Noble card? You don't.
No.
Independent bookstores sometimes have these, but I think most don't. We got some emails back, and my local indie doesn't. So it feels like most independent bookstores don't have a membership or a loyalty program.
I do some shopping remotely through our friend of the show, Josh Christie's bookstore in Portland, Maine, Print, and they do have a loyalty program. I could not tell you the particulars of it, but I put my phone number in anytime I order a book from them online, and every now and then when I've spent enough money, it's like, hey, guess what? You get a discount on this thing because you racked up enough points or enough dollars, and it does feel nice. For me personally, it doesn't go into the hopper when I'm making a decision about, am I buying my book there or am I going to go down to Barnes & Noble and pick it up, or is this something I'm going to read digitally? But it does feel nice, especially because when I'm doing indie bookstore orders, that's particularly when I'm ordering hardcovers of like debut authors that I really want to support. It makes a nice feeling difference. I don't know that it's much more than feelings, you know, like I'm looking at the new Rebecca Mackay sitting on my desk that was $28 in hardcover. Does the $280 I would have saved really matter?
No,
but the feeling does.
The feeling does. So anyway, so the bit about the Authors Guild, that was in Publishers Lunch. I can't really cite. I would give you the link, and it won't be in the show notes. But subscribe to Publishers Lunch if you're interested in that kind of thing. This is also not something I can link to. It was in, it's a email newsletter as opposed to a print newsletter. I guess you say newsletter at this point. that The Verge does, called Hot Pod. It's about podcasting. That I read, and I think we've pulled some stuff from it before.
Yeah,
but apparently they had their recent summit. Their podcasting summit, and they had folks from Spotify and PRH Audio and other places talking about audiobooks and Spotify. And this is not the title, Rebecca, of the piece. It was My Slug.
No.
And it says, Jeff GPT version was audiobooks and Spotify sound like a nothing burger. And they had a panel and talk, and it's interesting, and it sounds like a lot of nothing. And it's just as we suspected. Publishers are not interested in putting anything close to front list on anything other than a pay-per-download model, a pay-per-buy model. Yeah. We don't want ad-supported. We don't want pennies per minute listened for you or whatever. They have no magic here. Spotify has no secret deal to fight inflation, to quote the West Wing, about how to make the audiobooks basically a la carte or subscription, so you're buying credits, so it's a la carte, even though it doesn't feel that way. There's nothing here, Rebecca, is there? Did I miss something? I dropped this in kind of late, so I'm not sure if you had a chance to go through these few paragraphs.
But there's nothing here. It feels really analogous to what we were going through about 5, 6, 7 years ago with the desperate search for an all-you-can-eat ebook model that was subscription-based, and publishers showed us then that they weren't really interested. They want you paying, you know, per book for your front list, and it makes sense that that's what we're going to see with audiobooks. Yep.
So, if you're interested in podcasting, I would check out that newsletter.
Yeah, it's a good newsletter.
Recommendation I give for you. But like, maybe we could give you something, and maybe you could, and there could be. It was just nothing. I was really struggling to find something interesting there. So I think I'm also going to shelve that until I can get the new, I don't know. Well, we didn't talk. This could be a news post. The new Zadie Smith novel coming out in the fall, Rebecca. Historical fiction from Zadie Smith. Until I can get that on Spotify, or I see that that's other than $14.99 for a subscription credit or $24.99 for full price. Until the business model is something other than that, I'm checked out on audiobooks and streaming. I am. I'm done.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah. We gotta see some kind of disruption there for it to be worth exploring again. Mm-hmm. For sure. And right now our listeners can just put a little red circle around September 5th on your calendar, because not only that'll be Labor Day here in the U.S., but that's Zadie Smith Day now, my friends.
Yeah, we're already talking about our fall draft. We skipped right over summer drafts, which we're the fall draft is going to be a bloodbath.
Really, it really is. I haven't looked to see how the dates line up, but we know we're getting Zadie, we're getting Colson Whitehead, we're getting Lauren Groff. The announcements are just going to keep on coming. If they all came out on the same day, I think I might just leave my body. Like, I'm supposed to be on a plane going to another country on September 5th. And I was like, I guess I'm just going to read Zadie Smith on that plane. But I kind of want to reschedule my whole trip so I can just sit somewhere with Zadie Smith instead.
Just sit in. Maybe you'll get a nice long delay. You know, one of those.
There you go.
This is also some follow-on about, I don't know what we're calling this. You have James Bond books being updated without racist language. Vanessa and I talked about these Roald Dahl books. Updated, amended. Some people are using the word censored. I'm not using that word because that's not censorship. It's when you when you are the copyright owner and you change a word, that's like maybe the actual opposite of censorship. I don't know what to say.
Edited.
Edited, changed. I guess just changed. These are just changed versions.
These are value neutral things that are happening here. They are changing. Yeah.
The James Bond estate is doing something basically similar. We talked about the doll. There is more overt, well, there is overt racial epithets in some of the early James Bond books, especially. A little bit different here for this reason, I think. Apparently, I'm not sure if it's linked in this piece here that I pulled, but one of the pieces I was reading about, and I knew this because I did a read all the James Bond novels one summer and did a post for the site, and I did some reading about Fleming, and as he did some updating himself about some of the language he was using. And I don't remember if it's like the narrator's voice or characters' voices that said these particular words. And I think that matters because these are words that are used by people and especially were used in these kinds of contexts in other places. It doesn't mean it's fun. It doesn't mean I want to buy a book that has it in there. But it doesn't necessarily mean that Fleming himself was especially racist or racist. It means there are racist people. And when you're writing about people, that can happen. You know, okay, I guess maybe I'm coming around to you're the copyright holder. You get to do what you want. I think the historian in me still wants there to be versions that have the original because that matters. Like what it was changed from matters. And I do think it's different if it's the author that's still alive versus the estate that's doing it so they can continue selling books. I don't want the original versions erased. And libraries have them, and I hope those are preserved because I think that's important. For a new reader's perspective that just wants to have a good time reading about, you know, child spies or, you know, beaten Russians and stuff, I don't think it matters to their experience that much. If it changed, I think great. It's better. Take out some of the epithets, make it less vile, you know, make those moments less vile and we can get on with our lives. I guess like Vanessa said, I'm more interested in what else is there of the new that can be read. So I don't know. And then the other one is Roald Dahl's estate. You can also buy the you can buy Coke Classic too. So they're gonna have gonna have the racist ones and the fatphobic ones, and they're gonna have the other ones.
They should make the racist and fatphobic ones a little more expensive, so you have to pay the tax if you want that.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah,
I think I'm in a pretty similar place to where you are with these. I think this is good progress to keep stories and characters that, you know, are meaningful, that readers have loved. Like James Bond is James Bond. There's something really special about that. But we don't need to keep painful language that's harmful to people in these books if it can be updated and we're not meaningfully changing anything else about the experience. I think that's a very human, smart thing to do. I like the idea of the future I've been dreaming of here. The future liberals want is something like the new James Bond comes out and there are little asterisks with footnotes or references in the back of the book where if you want, you can see what the original language was. And over time, like I imagine what's acceptable to us now is not going to be what's acceptable to us in 50 years. And if James Bond is still with us in 50 years, over time, you accumulate a record of how that language has shifted. And that could be really interesting and educational in itself. Like everybody's favorite To Kill a Mockingbird is a candidate that's ripe for some kind of reexamination like this. And if you built into this process, keeping in the same book, like in the same physical object or the same ebook, a record of here's what the original was so that can be. So it's a reference, you know, if here's here are the changes we made. Here's what the original was. If there's a note from the author or a note from the editor, whoever holds the copyright, I think that would be great as well. I'd like to see, I think this is something that's going to be with us. Like, there's a place where if you want to continue selling James Bond books, if you want to continue selling Roald Dahl mm-hmm. books, the smart thing to do is take the offensive language out of them yeah. so that readers will still be comfortable and interested in engaging with your story. But let's do that in a way that lets us keep an eye on where we were and where we have moved to and where else we might be going in terms of language. I want to preserve that path, I think, as much as preserving the originals for the reference.
It is so strange because if Roald Dahl or Ian Fleming were alive and they did this themselves, I'd feel completely different about it. Because like, just because I hit publish on that day and that represented the best of my understanding on that day,
right,
doesn't mean I have to be held hostage to that forever if I learn something different. But it matters to me that these people are dead, because these people that are changing them hold the copyright. They may or may not have any interest in preserving or whatever the literary legacy. They're not the author. That's the thing. They're not the author. And on the book, it's still going to say Matilda by Roald Dahl. But this is not what he wrote, Rebecca. So like, yeah. There's a fundamental mistruth about what's going on there.
I think that's a place.
Attention must be paid. Attention must be paid that this is not the same thing.
I think that's a place where the asterisk and the footnote would also be useful, or to say these changes were made by the copyright holder or the publisher or whatever at this time. Maybe this is something for the Authors Guild to look into. Yeah. Do you need to start putting some notes into your contracts about after my death? If language evolves in a way that my text needs to be amended, here's what's cool and here's what's not, or here's how I'd like it to be noted or not noted. Like, language has shifted a whole lot just in the last 10 years. Like, I die a little on the inside every time somebody tells us that they're like reading a Book Riot post or listening to a podcast episode from 10 years ago, because we were different people and the culture was very different. And this is growth. This is what we want. Yeah. But like, that person 10 years ago with that set of understandings about the world was living in a very different world than we're living in today. And if someone had been like, hey, you're going to need to update your priors or update stuff as a writer when you have that book that's just out there. And it's we've thought of those things as permanent. And I think that we are seeing that as language evolves as quickly as it does, now that we're all so connected and we have the internet, some consideration of the book is not so much a permanent object, but maybe this is kind of a living document. And as an author, what can be living and what cannot be? How can it evolve and how can it not? And how should those things be noted, both for the importance of record and posterity, but also for the benefit of readers? It would be a really interesting question. I'd love to hear some people talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what's being troubled is that fixity of X book by Y author.
Right.
This is something other than that. And, you know, it goes, Ghost Head of Watchmen's a great example. Harper Lee didn't want to publish that book. Didn't.
Right.
Ralph Ellison didn't want to.
And you can see why.
Yeah. They didn't want to do it. And the estate is doing something different. And you can argue about whether that's good or should have just been a manuscript in a library, someone for scholars to do or whatever else it might be. But the fundamental truth is that when Roald Dahl signed off, or however it happens, that book came out when he wrote it, Matilda or these other ones, The Witches, that book is meaningfully different. And if it weren't meaningfully different, they wouldn't be doing it. If it didn't mean anything, they wouldn't be doing it. So by its nature, you can't argue that it doesn't matter. Because if it didn't matter, they wouldn't do it. So it's being changed in a material way. And some kind of acknowledgement, I think, is appropriate. And we don't have too much language for that yet, or how to do. Maybe an epilogue or some other notes to the reader.
Yeah, something.
Or, you know, a note on the type. You know, if we get more, if we get more information about the typography than the racial epithets being changed, that's a problem. That's a problem.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, Frontlist Foyer. What have you been reading? It's been a while since we've talked. I've got a billion things to talk about. I have no idea how to even start. I'm going to pick two things, but while I'm vamping, what have you been
reading? Okay. I read The Neighbor Favor by Christina Forrest, which is a really sweet little rom-com. It wasn't on my radar at all, and then I saw a starred review of it in Publishers Weekly that was like, this has You've Got Mail vibes. And I was like, click! It's about a young black couple in New York. Well, it starts with a young Black woman. She works in publishing. She's like toiling away with a kind of Anna Wintour boss. So there's also like some Devil Wears Prada stuff happening. She's on the train one day and the train is stuck. She's like getting kind of woozy. And in her wooziness, she Googles the name of the author who wrote her favorite sci-fi book, or it's a fantasy novel, which was like one of the first fantasy novels where she had ever seen Black characters. And so really seeing herself in this, she finds like, oh my gosh, he finally has a website and there's a way to email him. And so she emails the author just to be like, you changed my life. I'm not the kind of person who just sends emails through the contact form on authors' websites, but I just want to say thank you for having written this. Sending it off into the void. And then she kind of forgets that she's done it because she's having like a fever dream moment being stuck on this train in a heat wave. But the author writes back.
Wow.
And they start having this email exchange where they're eventually talking about their lives. He tells her, you know, after I wrote that, I was really young. I gave up on the idea of being an author. He's become a travel journalist. And so he's writing her emails from all over the world. They have like little periods where it falls silent because he's gone somewhere dangerous. And they start to really connect with each other. And then he decides to just drop off. He tells her, like, actually, I'm not who you think I am. I don't think this can go any further. And this is after they've kind of started like imagining what their first date together might be like. He just disappears. So she's really hurt. Things happen that lead them to accidentally, unknowingly end up in each other's proximity back in New York.
Great.
And yeah. And the story becomes about, when will she find out that that's who that person is? Is he going to tell her? What's going to happen after he tells her? On the like steaminess scale, it's very low. It's like pretty tame if you're looking for a not so spicy romance, but it was really well written. It was the rare book that is set largely inside publishing that I was like, this is fun. It wasn't, because it's not about be a book lover. Here's my book about book lovers. She's just kind of toiling away and she has this connection. He happens to be an author, but it's just sort of secondary. She just likes the thing that person has created, like the You've Got Mail vibes. That was a really good comp. It was really fun. I enjoyed it. Like that, it was just a fun read. I was glad to see it. And then let's see, I had a couple really good audiobook listens on my road trip last week. So I'll just second your emotion for Fieldwork by Ileana Reagan. Really good, man. So good. And you didn't tell me that, like, oh, 5 minutes into this, you're going to be Googling the Milkweed Inn in Michigan's Upper Peninsula.
I didn't want to even look.
And how to go stay there.
And how much it is. And the reservations are 9 years in the future.
You don't want to
know. I don't want to know.
But the whole thing is really lovely. I really liked her take. And it's a different flavor of like a big city fancy chef goes back to the land. So I really loved her voice. Not what I would have guessed was going to be her second memoir, like coming out of Burn the Place. It was really surprising.
It was surprising in a good way to me.
It's like, messier, you know, like people do.
But I liked it. It's messy.
Yeah, and like people do surprising things, and yes, I was surprised by her in a really good way. And then I also listened to "Becoming Free Indeed" by Ginger Duggar Vuolo, who is one of the Duggar daughters from the like I think the most recent version was the 19 Kids and Counting show on
it's too
TLC.
Many kids, Rebecca.
Yes, the family has many children, so she grew up in a sect of really conservative fundamental evangelical Christianity, and she has separated herself from the faith that she grew up in, but she is still a practicing Christian. And I was just fascinated by her story because it's not a tell-all, and she tells you from the very beginning, like, this is not going to be a juicy tell-all. She doesn't spend 300 pages dunking on her family, but I was like, what is it like? Like, this is functionally a getting out of a cult memoir, and at the very end of the book, she basically acknowledges that, and I wanted to see what the journey was. How did this person get out of this religious community that she was raised in? She's coming from the perspective of having watched a lot of other people who grew up in that same community, having done what she considers to be throw the baby out with the bathwater. They have left their faiths entirely through a process that's become known, I guess, in that corner of evangelical Christianity as deconstruction. Like, I'm deconstructing my whole faith no more religion of any kind for me.
Okay.
And she didn't have the desire to do that. She sort of shifted into what's like more of a like mainstream non-denominational Christianity. So she talks about disentangling. And the phrase that she uses quite a bit was disentangling truth from error, disentangling the truth that was inside the teachings I received from misinterpretation, from human beings, motivated reasoning, looking really honestly at the abuse that happens in those situations. The person who was like kind of the founder of this group was later accused very credibly by a very large number of women of having been inappropriate with them sexually when they were underage. And she just kind of, she goes right at it and lets the, she just lets all of these moments and all of these actions and teachings really speak for themselves in a way that, like, if you want to come down on a group like that or get the tell-all, it would be unsatisfying. Like, she's not going to rail about, like, and here are the 25 reasons why this is so bad. But she just does a lot of showing, and the showing does all the work. I was really impressed. Like, I was telling a friend who also read it, I feel like she's had some really good therapy and done a lot of processing, and you can see it here. And if the intended audience is who she's speaking to in the book of, like, if you've grown up in a group like this, you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You can continue to have some kind of faith practice. I think she has succeeded in writing the book that she wanted to write. Like, it's not where I have personally landed on ideas about that kind of faith. But she's like very successful in what she's done. And I was fascinated by, like, in any cult story, what starts putting cracks in the belief? Like, what are the experiences and the moments that just let enough light in that you start to question things and start to get out? And how does someone who's got 18 siblings, most of whom are still involved in this, get the guts to make that kind of move? And what kind of information or exposure to experience do you have to have that motivates you to do that really difficult thing and step away from not just your huge family, but this community that's really been all she's ever known? I think it's important work that she's doing with that book. I'm really glad that I spent 6 hours listening to it. I think if you have any interest in like cult memoirs or understanding what's going on in a religious community like that, why people are drawn to it and what gets them out of it, it's worth some time.
Cool. I'm going to do 4 things, but I'm going to group them, and I'm not going to go into excruciating or even useful detail maybe about any of them. Let's start with you want the good news or the bad news first, Rebecca?
Give me the bad news first. We can end on a high note.
You're not going to like this from me, I don't think. So two things that I was disappointed by, Enchantment by Catherine May and Saving Time by Jenny O'Dell. Look, some of it could be me, and this is why I'm going to couch it in this way, where I think I am no longer, if I ever was interested in the pandemic broke me and us, and now here is how to get in touch with X. Do you hear what I'm saying?
Maybe
towards the end of it, and we did Intimations with Zadie Smith, and we both really like that. I think that was so much more observational. I don't know. Neither of them were bad. I was just expecting more. I really liked Wintering. There's something about this idea. I mean, basically it's like, I'm broken. The pandemic broke us. Here's some ways to re-enchant the world. And I didn't find them particularly compelling. It didn't feel like self-exploring enough to feel like really wrestling with it in a way where Fieldwick really does wrestle with the mess. Right, it feels a little bit too neat. In some ways.
I'm going to interrupt you for just a second because I'm like a quarter of the way through.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Enchantment.
I didn't mean to spoil this for you, but
No. I'm like a quarter of the way in, and that articulates something that I've been feeling in that first quarter. Like, there are passages where Catherine May captures something, like something about like what the experience of feeling wonder is, and she does it in a like, yes, you got that. Or there's like a great paragraph about how your mind gradually gets quieter when you're on a hike or on a really long walk, and I think she's wonderful at that. But I've been having kind of the same feeling about it as I've gotten into it, of like, this book would have really helped me if somehow she could have time traveled and put it out in like the middle of 2021.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it's something like that. And it doesn't, I think there are paragraphs of brightness, But as a whole, and some of it can audio can do a weird thing where maybe it's broken up differently in print, and it can it can give it a different organization than we just hear the words sequentially without breaks that it really can't. And then saving time, I guess I knew. I'm not like, wow, clocks really screwed us up. Listen, I read A History of the World in 12 clocks, Rebecca. I know from time.
Okay. Is that what saving time is about?
Because
my excitement about Jenny Odell is just like, yay, Jenny Odell. But maybe I've done myself dirty by not knowing more about it.
Give yourself a chance. But like, you know, we've corporatized time and people have different relationship with time. And maybe it's messed us up. And it's good in its own way. But like, I feel like I've done this. I know this. It didn't really speak to me. Having read 4,000 weeks, it's more academic than that.
The bar is high.
I don't know. I didn't feel like I got that much time. It wasn't scholarly enough to be a history, and it wasn't sort of theoretically enough to, I don't know, screw with my ontology. And it wasn't like investigative enough to be like, if we did something different, it's like, well, we're not getting rid of
it. We're not gonna.
So I don't know. There was just something about it that just didn't live up to what I was hoping for.
Okay.
That's fine.
Interesting.
I was looking forward to them both. You can't bet 1,000. Two things, new to me authors that I both really liked. All the Beauty in the World by Patrick Bringley. Have you heard of this book?
No.
So it's his debut book, and it's a memoir. And basically what happened is he was working for the New Yorker in the events division. You know, they have these big events. Mm-hmm. Living his life in New York, has a, you know, a girlfriend he likes, and his brother lives around, and kind of living the post humanities, high achieving humanities lifestyle. His brother gets sick and passes away from cancer. So secret cancer book, not so secret. It's on the tin. Mm-hmm. And what he does, as you might imagine, this is not something easy to deal with. He seems especially close to his brother. He makes a career change and decides to become a security guard at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. To get in contact with beauty and slow down and really kind of take a step back and into his own life and be around art and really like this. I thought this book was actually better about time than Saving Time by Jenny Odell, frankly, because when he's there, he's just watching. Like he's on the clock, right? But like he doesn't have to be in a meeting. There's no X number of units he has to perform.
Mm-hmm.
He's just there to make sure things go well. And he gets a lot of time to look at art. And that's why he takes the job. And so some of it is his memoir of what this is like what's it like to be a security guard? How does the museum work? Which, you know, I'm into shit like that, for sure. But then also he does like his own close readings of like art. It's like, this is what this meant to me when I was stationed in this section for 6 weeks, when
Sold.
I was here every day for 6 weeks. I thought it was really great. I really liked it. It's not very long. He doesn't pretend to be a scholar, though he's an informed one. And he's not saying everyone should become a security guard, and I won't spoil it, but that's not what he's saying at all. But it's like this particular experience, he did it mindfully, and it felt like it was the right thing to do at this particular time. I don't know. It was really good. I hope it sells and people like it and he has a career, because it was really cool. I haven't read anything like this before.
I think I've seen that slugged as like memoir by Metropolitan Museum of Art security guard, but I didn't have any of the information about like the bigger frame there. Yeah. That sounds wonderful.
Pretty interesting. And then on the fiction side, Age of Vice by Depti Kapoor. I think it was one of the Jenna picks, or I don't know. Reese. It was one of those big commercial fic release from a PRH. One, I think it's maybe Doubleday. It doesn't matter. Knopf, Doubleday, one of those. And it's a big sprawling novel about a crime family in Delhi, in India, and people that get involved with it. I don't know anything about this world. I know very little about India, even though there's, you know, a billion people and more living there. It's not something I know a lot about, and I have no idea if this is accurate or not. But I thought the characters are compelling. It moved like a freight train, even though it was 550 pages long. I found the world really interesting. The writing was very good. It kind of reminds me of like if Don Winslow wrote a novel about a gang in India. He writes about gangs in New York like every other year, and I read them all. But this was like, oh, gang novel, crime, how the city is put together, investigative journalist, someone trying to get in, someone trying to get out, all the things that I like. I thought it was really good, and I think it was her debut novel as well. Commercial fiction, like kind of genre-y, I don't even know if it's genre-y. I don't think it's more literate, upmarket genre. I don't even know. I'm just kind of struggling a little bit because it is a it's crime because it's crime family, but it's not about one particular crime. I really thought it was great. And I was worried. The only reason I hadn't bought it earlier, because I read a couple of good reviews that came out in January, is that the dang thing is 520 pages. And I was like, oh, God. So I was in Powell's. I'm looking around. I was like, okay, I'm going to read 10 pages right here. And I got hooked. So I bought it and I flew through it in 2 days. So that's The Age of Ice. Actually, I think it might just be Age of Ice by Depti Kapoor. Those are my four picks. Two green arrows going up, two red arrows going down.
All right. I appreciate all of those arrows. And I have already purchased all the beauty in the world.
Yeah, there you can go. And you can find out what direction our arrow points for I Have Some Questions For You by Rebecca Mackay. I think so far, the most talked about literary novel of the year, or like commercial
I think that's
novel
right.
of the year.
Yeah.
That's going to be the Patreon going up. Well, if you're hearing this, it'll be up in a day or two, but we're going to record it and start in about 10 minutes and talk through I Have Some Questions For You by Rebecca Mackay, an author we both really like. The Great Believers, I think, was equivalently talked about when it came out in 2018, unbelievably 5 years
ago. Oh my gosh. Not acceptable. Oh, wow. No.
As always, you can find show notes, bookriot.com/listen. You can email us at podcast@bookriot.com. And we'll talk to you all very, very soon. Thanks so much, Rebecca.